lives. Slow down. This message brought to you by the New York City Vision Zero Initiative.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
If you knew what they were saying when they think you cannot hear, if you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear, if you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse, if you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. This week, I interviewed KJ Noe. KJ is an activist, a journalist, and a scholar on the geopolitics of the Asian continent. And we talked about the U.S.'s move from not just possible war with China, but a probable war with China, and members of the Pentagon saying that it may happen as soon as 2025 and are preparing U.S. troops for that. Just recently, the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, said that the U.S. would go to war over Taiwan. And KJ Noe talks about the fact that it may happen sooner because the U.S. has concerns about the upcoming elections in Taiwan in 2024, and looking at the last election, how this will move the U.S.-friendly government most likely out of power. China is changing its rhetoric. The U.S. has been building up a military presence and provoking China since the Obama administration. And China has been fairly restrained, but now they are setting some pretty clear red lines. And both Congress and the Pentagon are making preparations for war. We talk about what's happening in Korea, in Japan, how Taiwan is responding. Also, the leaders of Australia and the UK are coming to the U.S. this week to visit submarines in San Diego. And the U.S. is pushing Australia to be a big hub for this war. And this is not going to be a proxy war like the one in Ukraine, where the U.S. gets the Ukrainians to fight against Russia. But this would actually be a direct war where U.S. troops would be used to fight this conflict. So this is really has moved to a new level. It's imperative that we oppose a U.S. war with China. And this is another reason why folks should turn out on March 18th to the National Anti-War Demonstration in Washington, D.C. It begins at 1 o'clock in front of the White House in the Lafayette Square Park area. That will be followed a rally there by a march and then another indoor event, teach-in in D.C. If you go to popularresistance.org, you'll find in the slider more information about that demonstration. Contingents are forming. There's a veterans and GIs contingent. There's a climate crisis and militarization contingent, an artist contingent. People are organizing transportation from Boston all the way down to Atlanta, Georgia. And there are going to be some solidarity demonstrations in areas of the country that are farther away, particularly the West Coast. So check all that out at popularresistance.org. And this is an action that's being organized by more than 200 groups. And this is being seen as a great coming together. That's the beginning of more actions as we have such a dire situation that we face. This is really necessary. Before I get to that interview with KJ Noe, I want to talk about a few things that are in the news, and I'll start with a COVID-19 update. According to worldometer.info, which may be one of the only places left now where we can get some information on cases and deaths, the U.S. has more than 105.6 million documented cases and more than 1,149,000 deaths. There's about 10 to 20,000 cases being reported a day and more than 100 people dying per day. But these numbers, you know, are not being reported the way they were before, so it's likely that those numbers are higher. Also, for the best information on the status of the COVID-19 pandemic, check out the People's CDC. The Stop Cop City Week of Action has come to a close, and this week there were press conferences by the family of Manuel Teran Tortuguita, who was murdered by police while staying in the forest to prevent construction. An autopsy that was done independently now reveals that Manuel was likely sitting down with their arms up when police shot them. So this really counters that initial police narrative, which nobody thought was real, claiming that Manuel fired at the police. The police response to this week of action has been pretty severe, with 23 people arrested on March 5th at a music concert in the forest. This includes one legal observer. There were 35 people detained, but 23 of them ended up being arrested and charged with domestic terrorism. Now more than 40 people have been charged with domestic terrorism in relation to the efforts to stop Cop City. And this all goes back to a law that Georgia passed in 2017, a domestic terrorism law, after Dylann Roof murdered 9 people in a black church in South Carolina. The state of Georgia moved to loosen the definition of domestic terrorism, purportedly to go after white supremacists like Dylann Roof. But unfortunately, and as is usually the case, that law has been used more against people who are working for social justice, to protect the environment, to protect rights. And so they loosen the definition of domestic terrorism to include actions that intimidate a civilian population or that alter, change, or coerce government policy. So this is a very loose definition that could be applied to really much of the work that folks do to work for justice. And so now we see how this is being weaponized against the forest defenders. President Biden approved the Willow Project in Alaska. This is an oil drilling project that will release the equivalent greenhouse gases to 76 coal-fired power plants. It threatens the wildlife and the populations in that region who depend on that land for food. And so there was a lot of pressure on President Biden, this so-called climate president, not to approve this drilling project in the Arctic. Biden went ahead and approved it, and now folks are organizing to pressure him to reverse that decision. Of course, the big news today is the failure of some major banks, beginning with the Silvergate Bank on March 8th that was connected to the Sam Bankman-Fried cryptocurrency, caused a rush on cryptocurrency, which drove Silvergate Bank into insolvency. And then 2 days later, the Silicon Valley Bank failed. This is the 16th largest bank in the United States and the second largest bank to fail after Lehman Brothers. Now more banks are going down: Signature Bank, First Republic Bank, and shares of banks on the market are taking a big tumble today. Michael Hudson in Geopolitical Economy writes that this is a result of actions under the Obama administration to bail out the banks in 2008. And of course, there was a huge amount of quantitative easing that went on, and he calls this the great unwinding of that injection of capital into the banks, and also connects it to the response to inflation, where the Fed decided to raise interest rates, sacrificing jobs, employment, to raise rates. And this caused a decrease in bond prices, a decrease in the value of bank assets, and it drove these banks to fail. Hudson writes that more depositors are going to be moving their money into Treasury securities and away from the banks because the Treasury can print cash when it needs to. And so this may cause more banks to fail. Eve Smith in Naked Capitalism writes that the response to this, the bailout again of the banks, is taking place with no curbs on their risk-taking behaviors. And so this continues to set up the scenario that was set up in 2008, which is, you know, go ahead and take these risks because the government will always step in and bail you out if you need it. So who knows what's going to be coming in the next days, but in the European Union and the United Kingdom, there's another piece in Naked Capitalism on the increase in bankruptcies in those areas in Spain over the last year, 64% increase in bankruptcies of businesses. In Austria, 57%, France, 51%, Belgium, 42% increase. And in fact, the number of businesses going into bankruptcy is on track to surpass the number of new businesses that are being developed. The bankruptcies of these businesses is due to the pandemic and debt incurred during that, as well as the inflation and the decrease in demand. The House of Representatives voted last week against a resolution to get U.S. troops out of Syria. Of course, the U.S. has an illegal base in the northeastern part of Syria and is stealing Syrian oil. And the vote on that resolution to defeat it, 103 representatives voted for it, 321 against it. There was about an equal number of Democrats and Republicans who voted for that resolution to remove troops from Syria. But it was introduced by Matt Gaetz, a representative from Florida, who's on the extreme right. And this is, you know, a situation I talked about previously, especially a few weeks ago in the interview with Jackie Lukeman, where the Democrats are now the party of war. And so the Republicans are using the sentiment against war as a way for them to gain more supporters. And so we have to be aware of, you know, this being taken on as an issue by the extreme right. You know, they're not doing it because they're fighting for the same things that we're fighting for. The right doesn't oppose war fundamentally. It's just being used as a political issue, like the Democrats used the issue of abortion. It's something that they could have done something about a long time ago, but they don't, because it's such a good way to get people to vote for them and they promise to do something about it. And then finally, an issue that KJ Noe and I talk about in more depth in the interview is the agreement last week by Iran and Saudi Arabia to restore diplomatic relations. Joe Lauria of Consortium News has an excellent piece on this and the impacts that that is going to have in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, Bahrain, and how it really means that the U.S. has lost influence in this region. Another sign of the shifting global power. So I'll stop there, take a short musical break, and come back with the interview with KJ Noe.
What we need are teachers who understand the history of this country. What we need is a decent living wage. So people,
you're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, KJ Noe. KJ is a peace activist, a journalist, and a scholar on the geopolitics of the Asian continent. KJ, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Margaret.
And of course, you've been a guest on Clearing the Fog before, and there's so much happening right now in the Asia Pacific. Really wanted to get your insight into this. And so it feels like the United States is starting to even maybe turn a little bit away from the conflict in Ukraine with Russia and beginning to focus more. I mean, it has been focused on China for quite a long time, but it feels like things are shifting a little bit. And Korea is playing a big role in this. Maybe we could start out, before we get into a lot of the things that are happening with China, kind of what's happening in Korea right now under the new presidency, President Yoon?
It's quite alarming. And, you know, from the standpoint of the people, I think it's just one insult after another, one threat after another. South Korea is shifting back into very much a kind of police state approach towards its citizens. You know, for at least half of its existence, it was one of the worst military dictatorships on the planet. Mm-hmm. The recently elected president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who is a former prosecutor, that's the only political experience that he has ever had, has been turning the country back into what he calls a republic of prosecutors. And he's going after unions, union leaders, all of his opposition party competitors. he has just recently signed an agreement that essentially nullifies the Supreme Court award that was giving reparations to slave laborers who had been enslaved by Japan. And all of this is happening inside the context in which he is remilitarizing and hypermilitarizing in service of the U.S. agenda for war against China. Of course, they always use North Korea as a pretext. North Korea is simply a pretext. It's a non-issue. North Korea has a military budget of $4 billion less than the NYPD. But using North Korea as a pretext, they're continually escalating military exercises. They're doing, they've increased them by about 20-fold over the previous year. And South Korea and Japan are creating a de facto military alliance under the auspices of the United States to be the point of the spear against China. This is because the U.S. has operational control, de facto operational control over all South Korean troops. And if you include reservists, that's 3.5 million troops. And of course, Japan is an incredible military power. It's the fifth most powerful military in the world. And it will very soon have the third largest military budget on the planet. And it also is militarizing to the hilt in coordination with the United States, in particular, creating, buying Tomahawk missiles and creating a massive offensive missile capacity, what they refer to as long-range standoff weapons, once again, in order to attack China.
Right, and this is all being done because the United States is pushing, has control over. I mean, Japan had a in their constitution that they were not a country that could initiate military aggression, but under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, there was a big push by the U.S., and that was under during President Obama's time, to push them to change that. So can you talk a little bit more about kind of, I don't know if you have insight into how that's going with the population in Japan and the pushing for greater militarization?
Yes. Well, I mean, this plan for the remilitarization of Japan goes back at least until 1955. The Japanese are unrepentant militarists. They've never properly apologized for the colonization and the, you know, massacres that they committed all over Asia, not the least of which were at least 25 million Chinese killed. And, you know, essentially the annexation and colonization of vast swaths of the Asian continent and the archipelagos. So they're unrepentant militarists, but they've been trying to remilitarize since 1955. The LDP is the current ruling party, and it's a ruling one-party state. They've been in power almost continuously since they were created by the CIA in collaboration with the Yakuza and the unrepentant militarists, the former Japanese military fascists. So it's a kind of a toxic configuration that has always wanted to remilitarize. And it was stymied until around 2015, when they essentially reinterpreted their constitution to say that, you know, regardless of what our constitution says, if the United States goes to war anywhere on the planet, we get to join them and support them. And then more recently, they passed further amendments that allow themselves to remilitarize. And this is, you know, extraordinarily disturbing because Japan was put into the penalty box for a reason. What the U.S. essentially has done, it's green-lighted Japan's remilitarization, mm-hmm. and it's essentially given the felon its weapons back, or it's given permission for Japan to become an incredible military power, even under its peace constitution, you know, as a de facto, as only having self-defense forces, it was still considered the fifth most powerful military on the planet. Now that it is going full hog and it's doubling its military budget, we expect that, you know, it will be, you know, possibly the third or the fourth most powerful military. And that combined with Korea's incredible manpower, and Korea has the sixth most powerful military on the planet, all of that guided under the auspices of the United States, along with hundreds of bases dotted around the first island chain, lets us know that the United States is very, very serious about escalating to war against China.
Right, right. I think it was under the Obama administration that we moved about 60% of our naval capacity into that region. And then you mentioned the bases that the United States has. And then also, can you talk about the recent, I don't know if it was a new agreement. I know we have the Enhanced Cooperation Defense Agreement with the Philippines, but now the U.S. is going to have greater access to bases in the Philippines. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, the U.S. has added four new bases, as if it didn't already have enough. It had, if I'm not mistaken, five bases, and it was looking to reclaim, or it's actually an American corporation has rebought Subic Bay. And so they're essentially, this is vast amounts of real estate and logistical capacity that the United States is creating all over the Pacific, in particular in terms of preparing, pre-positioning stocks and troops and weapons, and also preparing for what we call the third offset, which is essentially dispersion warfare. China has the capacity to defend itself in its littoral waters, because it has developed missiles, pinpoint missiles that can defend its territory. And the United States is seeking to overcome this capacity by what they call the third offset, which is dispersed or swarming or diffused warfare. And so they're planning hundreds and hundreds of little preset positions from which they can fire missiles and then move and then fire again. You know, this is sometimes referred to as island hopping. Mm-hmm. They're also preparing subsurface warfare, a lot of long-range standoff capacity that is, you know, to be sent, missiles to be sent from a long distance away, and then automated warfare. And there is, you know, an extraordinary preparation, very, very detailed, to prepare for war. I think the most recent alarm was when General Minahan, you know, who is the general in charge of airlift, military airlift command, that is the logistics people, told his troops in a memo that they needed to prepare for war by 2025. And that they should all prepare to kill and to be killed and to set their affairs in order in preparation for this war. And he said this was, you know, the first of multiple messages that he was going to be sending out. So there's some very, very serious maneuvering happening. You know, in the military, we don't necessarily pay attention to the politicians, but we always pay attention to the people responsible for logistics, because that tells us what is really happening, what is really being prepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and even, I mean, now Congress is jumping in and playing a greater role with this new select committee on, they call it strategic competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party. Can you talk about, they just had their first hearings recently. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with that?
Well, it's part of the larger preparation or the process that I refer to as lawfare, which is legal warfare. So the Congress and the legislative body is passing hundreds of bills that are essentially declaring China the enemy and escalating to war. And most recently, we had the Taiwan Policy Act, which was kind of disassembled and put into the NDAA. And, you know, about a week ago, we had 10 bills passed, once again, weaponizing Taiwan. These are all bills that, one, demonize China, declare China to be the enemy, declare China to be an imminent and complete and total threat to the United States as they pack Taiwan with weapons to prepare it as kind of like a suicide porcupine, if you will, like a suicide bomber to turn Taiwan into a Ukraine type situation. Mm-hmm. And at the same time that they, fill the pork barrel for the Pentagon. So there's massive appropriations, massive, budgeting for war, and then extraordinary, harsh and escalatory rhetoric and preparations. There are also plans, for example, to place, they've just recently declared that they're increasing the number of troops on Taiwan fourfold. That takes it to 200, but already that's an extraordinary red line to place troops on Taiwan Island, because the Chinese have warned the United States not to do this, not to send arms and to demilitarize the island. And for the U.S. to openly declare it is quite extraordinary. It's, it's very, very escalatory. And at the same time, we understand that there are plans to make sure that these military troops will serve in an advisory fashion to the existing Republic of China Army, the Taiwanese Army, which actually is not strongly inclined to war against China. They are largely the KMT political party, and they believe in having good relations with China. And the U.S. is worried that this army will not fight, and they want to make sure that it will fight. There's a lot of legislative measures that are being put into place that demand and want to ensure that Taiwan will fight to the last person on the island, just as they've done the same thing in the Ukraine.
Right. Well, there was quite a long period in the Ukraine of the U.S. doing a similar kind of thing, playing an advisory role in the country, training, the military there, supplying them with weapons and ammunition. But the people of Taiwan, and Taiwan is different from Ukraine in that Taiwan is actually part of China. They must be looking at that situation. I mean, what's the response in Taiwan to what's happening there?
Well, I think they're quite horrified because they see that first they see what's happened in Ukraine, that the U.S. has simply used Ukraine as a kamikaze state to bleed and to strategically attack Russia. And the Taiwanese population, who the vast majority want the status quo, they do not want war. They certainly don't want to get involved as a proxy for U.S. war. They are, I think, completely horrified at what is going on. And you see that especially the KMT-affiliated thought leaders and people are very, very opposed to this, which is why the U.S. wants to make sure that, for example, in 2024, that the KMT does not take power away from the DPP, which is the current party in power. This is the Quisling pro-U.S., pro-imperial, pro-colonial, anti-Chinese party in power with Tsai Ing-wen. The U.S. wants to try and ensure that this party stays in power. Just recently, several months ago, there were local elections, and the DPP came out and said, if you vote for the opposition party, you're voting for China. And guess what? Everybody came out and voted for China. They voted against the ruling party. Right. And so I think that's a powerful referendum right there, But they have new elections for the president in 2024. I think the U.S. is very worried about this because they will lose their reliable vassals in the current government. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's either going to be one of two things. One is an acceleration to war, or possibly the declaration of martial law, or simply the instigation of war before then. This is why the U.S. is in such a hurry to have war against China. This is why Minahan said that, you know, we'll be at war by 2025, because it's the U.S. which is in a hurry, not China.
Right, right. Well, no, China certainly is not in a hurry, but talk a little bit about China's response to, I mean, it's been a long time, as you say, of the U.S. building aggression towards China. But what is most recently, how is China responding to that?
Well, you know, until very recently, China was very, very patient. You know, there was this constant attempt to reach out and to build relations and to de-escalate and constantly to, you know, encourage the United States to have, you know, a mutually cooperative win-win approach to the world and to each other. You know, Kurt Campbell, who was the, you know, who's in the current government, he's the Asia czar in the Biden administration, and he was the architect of the original pivot to Asia. Apparently, recently he went to a group of Chinese diplomats and told them, your win-win, your concept of win-win is bull. And he said this right to their faces. And more recently, you can see all the, you know, kind of rhetorical escalation against China. You know, they're saying, you know, they're spying with balloons. They brought the COVID lab leak theory back. Right. Essentially saying that China is a global WMD, biological threat to the world. They're saying once again that China is committing atrocities. And we know that when the U.S. goes to war, it always looks for that. It, you know, it inflates threats and it, you know, alleges atrocities. And these lies become more and more absurd. So the farther away from the truth we get, the closer we are to war. And I would say that just based on the sheer absurdities that we're hearing, we are getting very, very, very close to war. But China's response until recently was very, very muted. They really were holding out the olive branch, trying to find an off-ramp. And the U.S. was slapping them down at every opportunity. And so China has changed suddenly, or slowly, but dramatically. And recently, Xi Jinping at the two sessions, this is the legislative sessions in China, came out and said the United States is encircling us in order to suppress our development. And that's new because China has never mentioned the U.S. by name. It's like, you know, when you get angry and you call somebody by their full name, you know that you're in a different place. Well, China actually named the United States instead of simply saying some countries or, you know, certain factions. They actually named the United States, accused it of encircling and trying to suppress China. And then Qin Gang, who is the foreign minister, said that, you know, if you don't back down, we are going to look at catastrophic conflict, and essentially said that all bets are off. So very, very strong language coming from China. And also they put forth a document, two sets of documents, three documents, actually. One was a very, very strong condemnation of U.S. hegemony. Alleging, you know, and clearly pointing out U.S. violence, U.S. aggressive wars, U.S. bullying, and all of the suffering and violence that this has caused. And then on the other hand, they have put forth, a security initiative, a global security initiative. And as part of that, they've also put forth a 12-point plan for peace in the Ukraine, which I think is very well drafted, and it is at the very least a good start for all the parties to look at.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, this is the way that China conducts its foreign relations, which is completely opposite to what the United States does. And let's talk a little bit about some of those, because I mean, China has done human rights reports, assessments of the United States before and published those. But this report, Perils of U.S. Hegemony, it feels like China is sending a message to the world, you know, that, hey, we know all of this. We know the U.S. does this. We need to start naming it, because the majority of the world is not supporting the United States in its conflict with Russia right now. So could you talk a little bit about that report, Perils of U.S. Hegemony, and what you think that says politically?
I think it's a very strong statement, as you point out, to the global South. And it's saying that, you know, we are speaking out against U.S. hegemony, U.S. violence, U.S. imperial violence. And this is empowering other countries actually to speak back. And we see this with many of the African countries who are telling the U.S., you have no right to lecture us. They're telling European leaders, you know, get off your high horse, stop with the lecturing and start to be real and, you know, pragmatic. We also see this with Latin America. We're seeing it across the global South. But essentially, China is saying enough is enough. You know, let's call out the hypocrisy and let's, you know, do away with the illusions that somehow that the United States is or has been a benevolent force for freedom and democracy. The vast majority of the planet knows that that is not the case, that they have simply been, you know, extractive regions for U.S. exploitation and super profits that has, you know, driven and created, you know, extraordinary structural violence across the planet. And as China continues to build itself out, it creates a new pole of development, a pole of development which is non-Western and non-capitalist, or at least moving towards socialism. And I think that gives strength, succor, and power to the rest of the world. China, to this point, has never directly confronted the U.S. Militarily. It did so in 1950, at which point it, you know, handed the U.S. probably its greatest strategic defeat, military defeat in history. But the Chinese approach has been, and this is a commonly used analogy, is that the Chinese play the board game of Go. And in Go, the object is to connect. You connect in order to live. If you look at the West, it's often being pointed out that they're playing the game of chess, which is to say you occupy and capture in order to kill. And so we have two very different worldviews. One is strategic, long-term, and which builds relationships in order to live, literally by building out the Belt and Road and by trading with countries and by trying to create a multilateral system of cooperation, of mutual benefit, of win-win cooperation. And on the other hand, you have the West, in particular United States, playing this tactical game of chess, which is all about positioning, capturing, killing, threatening, and it's very short term, and it's all about domination. That is, we're looking at essentially a contestation between military domination and economic co-development. I think these are the paradigms that we're facing right now, right? Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic was an excellent example to show the differences. Whereas China was, you know, sharing information, sending supplies to other countries, sharing its vaccines, you know, donating hundreds of millions, if not billions of doses of vaccines, the United States was imposing greater economic blockades on other countries, was pushing the World Trade Organization to prevent it from sharing information on patents so that other countries could produce their own medicines and vaccines. You know, was doing, and then weaponizing, as we talked about, you talked about COVID against China to use it as a way to demonize China. Do you have any thoughts?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. I mean, the COVID was kind of a great watershed moment because it showed the difference between what happens under a capitalist neoliberal regime, which seeks profits above people, and a socialist planned economy that values human life and places that above any notion of, you know, self-interest and profit, and the kind of global solidarity that, you know, China and also Cuba showed with the rest of the world, as you point out, not simply sending medical supplies and vaccines, and yes, billions of vaccines, you know, outnumbering what the West sent on a factor of 10 or 20, and then sharing information right from the get-go, starting January 5th, the Chinese researchers posted it, you know, the entire genome to GenBank. And anybody who, you know, cares to check the record will see that, you know, within a week, the Chinese had isolated and posted the genome. It's not January 12th, but January 5th that it was posted to GenBank. And then, of course, even for the United States, you know, everything that the United States was doing in terms of masks, even vaccines, you know, those little glass vials or the extreme refrigerators that were necessary to preserve the mRNA vaccines, all of that came from China. You know, there was this kind of deep, you know, goodwill and generosity that China was manifesting at the same time that the U.S. was using COVID as a way to undermine and attack China very, very deliberately. You know, we saw this coming out of the National Security Advisor, who, you know, literally said, you know, forget about testing, forget about vaccines. How do we use this opportunity to, you know, really, you know, hurt China? That was, you know, very, very much in their, you know, mindset. And then we saw the endless propaganda and information warfare and, you know, trillions of dollars worth of lawsuits being prepared against China for, quote unquote, unleashing COVID on the world. Just a very quick statement. You know, this whole notion that that China leaked this COVID virus that was recently re-released. This was written by the journalist who created the hoax, who published the hoax about the Iraq WMD. This is Michael Gordon. Mm-hmm. And so the same person, literally the same person, is creating the same type of WMD hoax, and they're being given, you know, the time of day. It's kind of astonishing. But anyway, you know, the key thing is, even if you think that somehow China was responsible for some kind of lab leak, you have to understand that whatever China was doing, this was U.S. funded. Mm-hmm. And if you want to argue that was engineered or serial passage, you have to show what the progenitor was, what the precursor was. Nobody has been able to show that.
Right.
And if you argue that it was simply a leak of an existing virus, then that is probably the most statistically unlikely event to happen. You know, bats are, you know, 20% of mammalian species, and hundreds of millions of people have interactions with bats every single year. And so to think that it was some kind of leak that happened from a BSL-4 lab, as opposed to the millions and billions of interactions that people have on a general basis, you know, this is like arguing that a mouse that you saw in the street in New York somehow escaped from, you know, a university laboratory, as opposed to being one of the millions of rats that are already living there.
Let's talk a little bit about, if you have time, with the newest development. China helped Iran and Saudi Arabia have a negotiation, and they're now have agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations. Talk about what, you know, the role that China played and what that means for that region. And of course, then, you know, the United States and its ally Israel.
Well, I think it's an extraordinary event, because what it does is it signals that, you know, there is movement towards peace in Western Asia. And it also signals great momentum towards an Asia-centered multipolar world, as we said, you know, with trade and development-focused cooperative multilateralism. And this signals the weakening of this kind of empire, U.S. Western empire-driven divide and conquer, where the West is colonized, balkanized, and fanned conflict in the Middle East, especially where it weaponized, you know, Wahhabism and Salafism against its enemies. So China is, you know, as we pointed out, it's mediating, it's reconnecting, it's building the connections for peace. And this has to do with China's strong relations with Iran. Iran has just recently joined the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, and it has signed a 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership with China. And at the same time, China had been strengthening relations with the Gulf cooperation countries, as recently demonstrated in the recent visit of Xi Jinping to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is now seeking to join the BRICS. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And there were multiple agreements signed with all of the leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council, including Saudi Arabia. And this is very, very striking, because traditionally Iran and Saudi Arabia have been enemies. It's, you know, it's their serious political and historical and religious differences that have manifested. But the fact that they've reestablished diplomatic relations and that they are seeking to, you know, move towards cooperation and peace is extraordinary. You know, it originally looked like this was not possible, because, you know, China was trying to be friends with Iran and Saudi Arabia, who are, you know, sworn enemies. Mm-hmm. But behind the scenes, the Chinese diplomats were working very hard to resolve those contradictions. And what happens moving forward is that where Saudi Arabia goes, the other Gulf cooperation countries are going to follow. And this puts real wind into the drive towards de-dollarization. The lifeblood of the global economy is essentially still fossil fuels. It's, you know, and it's the U.S. petrodollar, which has been the foundation of the U.S.'s unlimited credit card that the U.S. has used to fund its endless wars around the planet. And once you start to undermine or take away that credit card, and as the global economy shifts towards the seven R's, that is to say, the Brazilian real, the ruble, the rupee, the renminbi, the rand, and the Saudi real, plus the Iranian real, as we start to move into various baskets of currencies, especially the seven R's, this will seriously undermine U.S. hegemony and U.S. economic power. And then that will have positive effects, I believe, in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Bahrain, and Yemen, which have functioned as proxy conflicts between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the West. It could also have positive effects with Israel. And I think this is the first of many, many steps, but I seriously believe that it is an important opening towards a more peaceful world.
Right, right. Well, hopefully. I mean, I think the U.S., I think, is just showing its weakness, its response. I don't know if this was a direct response to Saudi Arabia and Iran having this agreement, but the U.S. just announced a new set of sanctions and accused of, you know, the United Arab Emirates and Hong Kong of engaging in shadow banking to conduct financial transactions with Iran, because the U.S., of course, has sanctioned Iran and then tries to impose secondary sanctions on countries that do business with Iran. But, I don't think the world is going to keep going along with this. I think China's response was, these are illegal measures that the United States is trying to impose.
Absolutely. These are illegal sanctions, just as the sanctions against Russia are illegal as well, because the U.S. does not get to unilaterally impose sanctions. Sanctions are, let's put it kindly, let's tell it like it is. They are an act of war. They're the modern equivalent of siege warfare. And the U.S. wants to engage on sanctions with every country that it dislikes, and to engage secondary sanctions on those who trade with the countries that it's trying to sanction. But that is not working anymore, because the U.S. has overused sanctions. Secondly, because the Global South, the vast majority of the countries are seeing that the U.S. does not have the force or the power to sanction every country. You know, it's currently sanctioning one third of the planet, and it's trying to sanction even more. But at a certain point, if you build a wall around your neighbor, perhaps you've enclosed them. But if you try and build a wall around an entire city around the entire world, then essentially you've simply enclosed yourself. Right. And that is what the U.S. is starting to do with itself, with its decoupling against China and the endless, endless sanctions that it's abusing, the way that somebody who knows nothing about medicine abuses antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's all coming back. It's having negative consequences on the United States and on its, particularly with the Russian sanctions on Russia with our Western allies. So what do you think, or what would be your advice to people in the United States? This is very concerning. We see what the U.S. has done to Ukraine and is willing to sacrifice, as we say, the last Ukrainian in our conflict with Russia, now turning even greater, towards greater conflict with China. And the United States does not have the resources to engage in a war with China. It's not something that the U.S. would have any ability. I mean, I guess the U.S. is trying to use Australia and other countries to fight this war for it. But what's your advice to people in the U.S.? What should we know? Where should we get information? What should we be doing to try to prevent this?
I think the first thing that we have to understand is that this war is very, very real. It's very, very imminent. The U.S. has put a timeline on this war. And we know how serious it is, not simply because of the logistical maneuvers, the tactical, the strategic, and the operational maneuvers, but also because of the extraordinary, extraordinary information warfare. I always say that, information warfare precedes kinetic warfare. It's the subkinetic or pre-kinetic dimension of war. Mm-hmm. And as the United States increases its bellicose rhetoric, you can be quite sure that we are moving closer and closer to war. Now, the other very, very serious signal that this is getting out of hand is the attacks on Asians in the United States. Right. Everybody I know who's Asian has had a direct attack on them or know somebody who has. It's truly getting out of hand. It's like East Asians are afraid to leave their homes or go out because the violence is so extraordinary. And when you have that level of violence, that's simply a reflection of wholesale policy. If you demonize an entire group of people, that wholesale demonization on a policy level will trickle down onto the retail level. And so that you will see individual attacks against people here. You cannot attack and demonize a vast group, an entire country over there, without some of that blowing back right over here. And so I believe we're very, very close to war. I believe that we have to be very, very mindful that this is what is happening. And so then that gives us several duties. One is that we have the duty to oppose the war any way possible. There's, you know, early movements of an anti-war movement, but anything that you can do to support peace movements and anti-war movements, especially the coming March 18th, march and protest, I think is very, very important. I think it's absolutely necessary to completely and totally be cautious of anything the United States is saying about China, because at this current moment, it is all propaganda and information warfare to manufacture consent for war. In other words, when they tell you absurdities, they are preparing for atrocities, the atrocities of war. So we have to be extraordinarily cautious about the kind of information warfare. And I name, for example, organizations like Democracy Now!, which have gone whole hog into preparing the American population for war. This is happening both in, quote unquote, the pseudo or self-named progressive media, as well as the mainstream media, which is, you know, essentially that's just a cesspit of lies and propaganda. And so be very, very careful about any quote unquote news coming out against China. You have to take all of that with a very large grain of salt, you know, lab leak, balloons, you know, spying, you know, that they're spying on you with cranes, etc., that your refrigerator is spying on you. All of this is designed to build, to manufacture consent for war. And then do whatever you can to support peace movements, and do whatever you can to rein in your own politicians. We don't live in a democracy. It's a, you know, a plutocracy that we inhabit, but still sometimes we can get a little bit of traction with our supposed representatives. And if they are supporting war against China, if they're supporting weaponizing Taiwan, and they always use the word deterrence, but deterrence is simply a euphemism for war, for aggressive war. If you see them doing that, then I think it's important for us to let our opinions be known and to really do everything humanly possible to prevent further escalation. Because if this continues, not only will it be war with Russia and China, but it will be world war. It will be, you know, global nuclear war. And at that point, all bets are off. And the sad thing is that there are, in the current U.S. Administration, the ruling elite, there are millenarians, and they're such extreme ideologues that they believe that they can win a war against China. And they also believe that, you know, to put it simply, that it's better to be dead than red. They still have that Cold War thinking going on. And this is why they need to be restrained and challenged at every possible juncture.
Absolutely. Well, KJ, thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you for taking time to speak with me today.
You're so welcome.
Well, that's all for today. You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Pacifica Radio is listener sponsored. If you like what you heard today, consider becoming a Clearing the Fog buddy by making a monthly donation to WBAI.org.
I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was KJ No. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
To you.
Thank you for thinking of me.
And I thank you.
I thank you.
Let us say thank you, all you people out there.
I want to thank thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.